Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us. The tragic school shooting in Sparks, Nevada, that left two kids wounded and two people dead yesterday, has revived the conversation and debate over gun violence and school safety. Today, we'll take a closer look at what it will take to make Michigan schools safer for the kids. And then, with overnight temperatures in the 30s and talk of snow in the air, we ask, are we headed for an early winter? But first, a water dilemma is brewing next door in Wisconsin. The city of Waukesha is asking for permission to tap into Lake Michigan for drinking water to the tune of 10.1 million gallons a day. Waukesha is in a real bind. The aquifer that has provided most of its drinking water for the past century has dropped so far that what's left behind has unhealthy levels of radium and salt. So the city is under a federal order to find itself a new source. And Lake Michigan is just 15 miles from the city of 70,000 in the Milwaukee suburbs. But Waukesha has the bad luck to be a mile and a half outside the watershed boundary that encircles the five Great Lakes. And that opens up complicated questions that center on this. How do we balance the need for public water supplies with the need to protect the Great Lakes? Knowing that many states and communities are casting longing eyes on the Great Lakes is what led to the Great Lakes Basin Compact. It was signed into law by President George W. Bush just before he left office. Noah Hall is a Wayne State University law professor. He helped to draft the compact, and he joins us now. Noah, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Give us a refresher course on what and who is a part of this compact and why it was needed.
Sure. Well, a compact's a pretty unusual lawmaking tool. A compact is essentially a contract between states, just as you and I could contract in a private deal. Mm-hmm. It's a contract between states. The Great Lakes Compact includes all eight of the Great Lakes states, from Minnesota to New York. And in this compact, the states committed to several really key policy goals. First and foremost, they would not allow any diversions of Great Lakes water to distant states away from the basin. Secondly, when they use water within the basin, they would do it so responsibly, make sure to put in place water conservation measures, protect the environment, that type of thing. And then third, they would agree to a consultation and informative process where they would evaluate applications and proposals for new water use, consider them under some objective standards and with a fair process, and then subject their decision to judicial review to make sure that a court will sanction the decision they make.
And this, because it was signed by the president, has the weight of federal law.
Yeah, not only was it signed by the president, it passed Congress, and maybe it was a bygone era, but it passed the Senate under unanimous consent and passed the House of Representatives with a tremendous overwhelming majority. And it was signed into law by President Bush, who many have questioned the environmental record.
Okay, so I'm Waukesha. My longtime water source is tainted with radium. I'm under a federal order to get myself a new water source. I'm 15 miles from Lake Michigan. Water manager says 10.1 million gallons a day is the equivalent of a teaspoon out of an Olympic-sized pool. So why not allow me access to Lake Michigan?
So everything you said is correct. And first of all, Waukesha is very close to Lake Michigan. If Waukesha were, you know, we're in Oakland County, mm-hmm. or something, it would be just a suburb. But because of Wisconsin's rather unique geography, communities that are really just suburbs of Milwaukee sit outside of the Great Lakes watershed, which means when it rains in Waukesha, the rain that lands on the ground doesn't run into Lake Michigan, but actually eventually feeds rivers that lead to the Mississippi River. Mm. So first of all, while Waukesha is very close to Lake Michigan, nature didn't really put it within the Lake Michigan watershed. Secondly, you're absolutely right. The amount of water that Waukesha would be using, though, is tiny. It's really not even measurable in the scheme of the entire Great Lakes.
Which, by the way, is just a stunning reminder of how huge the Great Lakes is and what a resource it is.
Well, that's the truth. And frankly, that's really the point, is that if our only concern with water use in the Great Lakes is this going to lower lake levels or have a big measurable impact on the lakes, then nothing would ever register. The
right.
lakes are too big. Really, what's at issue here for both the opponents and the proponents is the idea. It's the principle. It's the notion of taking water out of the place where nature put it, away from the communities that surround the lakes themselves, and moving it to another location. And it's really the principle, some would say the precedent, Some would say, this is a test case for how the Great Lakes region is going to treat its water.
And it's interesting because it is a city that is so close. It's in Wisconsin. It's not South Dakota trying to tap into the Great Lakes. It feels like it's family, or does it?
Right. Well, just to be very clear on what the law is and what the law is not, if this were South Dakota, Nevada, mm-hmm. Arizona, and of course any other country, the legal answer is absolutely no. The Great Lakes Compact strictly prohibits diversions to places, those distant places from the Great Lakes region. However, the Great Lakes Compact left open a very narrow window for communities that are in the Great Lakes states but just outside one of these basin watersheds to, for very limited and really quite limiting reasons, seek and use Great Lakes water.
So Waukesha is a test case for this.
Waukesha is the test case for this. And, look, we knew this was coming. Mm-hmm. When we were discussing, negotiating, drafting the Great Lakes Compact, we knew the city of Waukesha was facing the dilemma that they're still facing, that their local supplies of drinking water weren't safe and that they would be seeking Lake Michigan water. And like all negotiations, well, maybe not all, at least most at the policy level, we decided the best solution was to punt it down the road. And the reason we did it is that if we had tried to make an ultimate binding decision on whether or not Waukesha would get its water, it would turn the Great Lakes Compact from really more of a cooperative policy that everyone was supporting to a line in the sand that would divide communities and really supporters of Great Lakes protection. So we did really, I think, the most reasonable thing under the circumstances. We left open a very narrow window. We defined the specific reasons and the standards, and we provided a fair process for future decision makers to consider the application on its merits.
Now, has anybody gotten in under this narrow window? Has there been anyone allowed into the party?
Well, no. There's been one other diversion, but it wasn't subject to the same standards because it was for a city that straddles the basin divide. Not to be too technical, mm-hmm. but if it's a city that straddles the basin divide, there's one set of exception standards that would apply.
Okay.
If it's a community like Waukesha that sits entirely out of the basin divide but is within a county that straddles the basin divide, they have a narrow window left open for them.
So you've done the one. That was New Berlin?
New Berlin, exactly.
City. So you have the city. Now you have a city like Waukesha. So it is outside, but it's in a county with one foot on one side and one foot on the other, so to speak, straddling
that. Exactly. It would be like Oakland County or something mm-hmm. if the basin divide ran right through there. And frankly, for folks in Wisconsin, this issue isn't just about water, but there's a major city suburb subtext to this dispute. Folks in Milwaukee are really opposed to the investment of resources and infrastructure and probably new economic growth mm-hmm. out in the suburbs. And folks in the suburbs are resentful that the city is essentially locking up water resources and preventing them from growing and meeting market demands.
And something tells me that this scenario could repeat itself all around the Great Lakes.
Yeah, there's at least a dozen communities that are watching this closely. But really, you know, the test case, I think, is more about policy and almost even ideology about how we should be using Great Lakes water. These communities are not going to affect Great Lakes water levels. They're not going to cause the lakes to drop. They're not going to use up the water. It's a really narrow exception. And even if the test cases show that folks are able to meet this narrow exception, it's not going to be like the door is wide open to Great Lakes water for the whole country.
So what do we watch for? What's going to happen?
I think we should watch for several things. And frankly, they're the same things I always watch for in environmental disputes. Is the information and the facts that are being discussed correct? You know, are folks being misled or do they have the right information before them? Is the right range of values and considerations being taken into account? You know, are we consider? There's a lot of diverse perspectives and values at stake for the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that the process is taking into account not just one set of values, but the whole range. And finally, you want to watch and make sure that the process is fair. And if folks basically can see this unfold and see that the information that's being used is accurate, the values that are being considered are fair and inclusive, and that the process that's provided makes sense and is treating everybody equitably, I think we'll be satisfied with the decision, even if it's not the decision we would all make.
And all eight states have to say yes, don't they? If one dissents, it doesn't happen.
That's right. If one dissents, it doesn't happen. But in that way, the states really aren't the final say. As I mentioned before, mm-hmm. there's judicial review, which means a court has the final say. So if one state holds out for political reasons or in legal terms, arbitrary and capricious reasons, mm-hmm. A court won't hesitate to strike that down and essentially order the right decision to be made.
What kind of timetable are we looking at?
Oh, it's going to be a while. These processes move very slow. There's going to be the application through the state. The state has to go up to the Compact Council, which is the representatives of all of the states. There's consultation with the Canadian provinces, what's called regional review. So this is going to take several months at least to unfold. And then, of course, there'll be the inevitable legal challenges from all of the folks that are unhappy with the decision.
Noah Hall, Wayne State University law professor. He helped draft the Great Lakes Water Basin Compact, and we will be watching as the story unfolds with Waukesha. Thanks for coming in and talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Still to come, hey, it's only the middle of fall, but already predictions of snow are flying around the air. Coming up, are we in for an early winter? And then with more than one-third of Michiganders considered overweight, well, we wondered, has that stopped the fat activist movement? We'll find out more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As I grabbed my gloves and heavy coat this morning, I noted the thermometer read 33. Wait a minute. 10 days ago, it was 79 degrees. You've got to love Michigan's weather. It certainly keeps us on our toes. With talk of snowflakes in Flint and friends in northern Michigan writing on Facebook about predictions of snow on October 22nd, we wondered, are we in for an early winter? Meteorologist Mark Torregrossa joins us. Are you getting accusatory glares today, Mark?
In Michigan, it's real tough. 50% of the people love snow. 50% hate it.
This is true. and of course, it's not as if you can turn those snowflakes on and off at will.
No, but I got to really, play politician when I talk about snow. I'm in the camp that I love snow, actually, until about February 1st, and then I could be done with it for the rest of the year. But the first snowstorms, I'm just about as happy as a little school kid.
You know, I'm gonna put my cards out there. I am with you. I always actually feel bad that today's kids don't seem to be getting, you know, that good dose of snow that I remember growing up here in Michigan with, where you know it'd snow around December and then we'd have snow to play in. And you're right, February, early March, you're ready to see it go away.
Right. The kids nowadays, I tell them, have not had a big blizzard like some of us remember, 1978 or 67.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some good snows here in Michigan. It's kind of surprising when you look at the stats, but we haven't had a blizzard where you get 20-plus inches of snow and then you get 3 or 4 days of 50-mile-an-hour gusts after it.
Yeah. So, Mark, the UP...
Maybe this will be our year.
I wonder, because here we have the UP under a winter weather advisory today. Is this a little early for that kind of activity?
It's probably about a week early.
Okay.
So it's really not, for them, it's really not too early. And in all of lower Michigan, I always say Halloween is about the first time where we normally see a few flakes of snow around. What is early is the strength of the cold that's up in Canada and coming this way. I think, you know, the snow right now, that doesn't shock me. But I think what we're going to be shocked at is a week or two down the road, how it almost may feel like December. And when that happens this early, it can make some real interesting weather in Michigan. It can make some very heavy lake effect snow about a month earlier than what you'd normally expect it.
So you're telling the folks on the west side of the state, get brace yourselves?
I'm telling everybody get ready, because we've had a nice run. If you like this weather, it looks like it has a potential to change dramatically. And I think this year, if that cold slides down as easy as it has been coming down in the last 8 months, I think this year is going to be a year where winter starts a lot earlier than later.
So, Mark Torregrossa, is it time for me to surrender and haul in the cushions from the backyard chairs?
I would say yes, yes, definitely. From what I'm seeing is this is going to be a chilly snap here. We may rebound in temperature a little bit, but I think the next cold snap is going to be colder and last longer.
I'm live meteorologist Mark
Torregrossa. You're about ready to hang up, aren't you?
Nah, you know what? I'm just going to pull a good sweater out of the closet. It's all right. We're in Michigan, and I've had more people comment that they love the four seasons. You know, if you don't want four seasons, move elsewhere, right?
Right. You know what will be interesting is we've seen this a lot of years. The cold comes down early, and it uses itself up, and we do an about face in the middle of winter. My gut feeling also on the other side is I think this pool of cold is stronger than we've seen in quite some time, and I'm wondering if it's going to stick for the whole winter and make a real winter here.
MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. Thanks so much, Mark.
Okay.
Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project, the station is partnering with the Detroit Free Press, the Center for Michigan, and WDET, hosting community conversations with Detroit residents. The goal? To hear from Detroiters about what they see happening in their city and what would make it a place where they can see themselves building a future. Michigan Radio's All Things Considered host, Jen White, will be hosting one of the conversations this Thursday evening, and she joins me now. Good to have you here, Jen.
Glad to be here, Cindy.
So tell us what's behind these conversations.
Well, as part of our State of Opportunity project, we're trying to understand what would make Michigan a place where all kids can have a future. And as we know, Detroit is in a time of massive change.
Yeah.
There's a municipal bankruptcy. People are feeling a little adrift. And what we wanted to try to get a better understanding of is how Detroiters feel. So not the pundits, not the talking heads, not the political analysts, but residents of the city. What do they see as being part of Detroit's future, and how do they see themselves as a part of that future?
So you're going to bring them together. What are you hoping to get from the people who come to the conversation you're going to host?
Well, part of what I hope to get is first how they feel about the city right now as it stands. People who are living in the city are typically very committed, from what I understand. They are living there not out of a sense of responsibility, but they just feel like their roots are there in the city and they don't really want to leave. So I want to understand what keeps them there a little more. But also beyond that, what they think needs to happen to the city to make it a livable place.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they envision Detroit in the future, what does that city look like to them? And do they see a future for themselves in the city? Sometimes it feels like the city's on two different tracks. You have neighborhoods, but then you have all this development happening in the midtown and downtown
Sure.
areas. And do those people see themselves in each other's version of Detroit's future?
And you also have the folks you described who have roots and have been in Detroit and in its neighborhoods because that's where my great-great-grandma
mm-hmm.
lived.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the newer people coming in where I'm sure there's going to be an interesting take on what their thoughts are.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, what I've been observing just in how the coverage has rolled out around Detroit is that those voices aren't often at the table. They're not often heard. You know, we hear a lot about the politics. We hear a lot about the bankruptcy, but we don't hear a lot from the people actually living there.
Jennifer White is Michigan Radio's All Things Considered host. Thank you so much, Jen.
My pleasure.
And if you're a resident of Detroit and you'd like to be part of one of the community conversations this Thursday evening, you can get all the information you need and reserve a spot at michiganradio.org. There was a bit of a stir recently when Elle magazine came out with its annual Women in Hollywood issue. Covers were shot with four different stars: Reese Witherspoon, Shailene Woodley, Penelope Cruz, and Melissa McCarthy. Witherspoon wore a fitted black dress. Woodley wore a swimsuit. Penelope Cruz recently gave birth to her second baby, so hers was a close-up face shot. And then curvy, full-figured Melissa McCarthy was swathed and bundled up in a great big coat. That led to criticism that it was because she's full-figured, although it should be noted Melissa McCarthy herself said she was thrilled to be a part of the cover scene. But it does raise the question of society's attitudes toward overweight people. 35% of Michigan's population is considered to be overweight. So this is an issue affecting many in our state. Is there a bias towards fat people that wouldn't be tolerated elsewhere? Joining me is Amanda Levitt. She writes the blog Fat Body Politics. She's currently a grad student at Wayne State University and a leader in the fat activist movement in Michigan. Welcome, Amanda.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what were your thoughts with all of the conversation about that Elle cover shot of Melissa McCarthy?
It's not abnormal. I mean, photoshopping happens in every single...
Well, this
single...
wasn't even photoshopping.
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
This was like, put her in a big coat. We see this gorgeous face, and
yeah.
But we don't see her.
Well, no. And I mean, what I want to say was photoshopping happens regardless of the body size. But when you look at Melissa McCarthy, mm-hmm. you don't see her body at all. We have very similar body types. And if I was in that coat, you would still be able to tell that I was fat. Like, you can't hide that. And so I think that's the part that clearly either they think that she is far bigger than she actually is, and so they bought a coat that was four times too big, or the entire idea was to disassociate herself from her body.
Well, let's talk about attitudes, and I'll just talk about Melissa McCarthy for another moment or two. Film critic Rex Reed, when he reviewed her work for the movie Identity Theft, he described her, and I'll quote now, a hippo, tractor-sized, and he called her, and again, this is my quote, I'm quoting Rex Reed, a gimmick comedian who has devoted her short career to being obese and obnoxious with equal success. Does that kind of language pretty much sum up what you're fighting back against as a fat activist?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, too, Melissa McCarthy specifically is very unapologetic about her body. Yeah, I mean, there's so much about being in the spotlight where you are taking up space and you are using your body. I mean, she uses physical humor. And so that's so incredibly revolutionary because we don't have fat women that are on TV that are doing that.
Roseanne Barr was kind of a trailblazer.
Yeah, we did about, there was a very huge break between Roseanne Barr and Melissa McCarthy. I mean, I remember when she was on SNL and she was doing the skit where she was like falling down. And it was just the fact that you had to look at her body. You can't look anywhere else. You can't just look at her head. Mm-hmm. And so when you see that, where she is doing something that's so much physical humor, where you're consistently having to look at her body, and then you see the cover of Elle, where all you see is her face, and it's only half of her face, and you could totally tell that they photoshopped her face too, and then they're covering and hiding her. It's a total disassociation from anything else that she normally does. And so it's like, in her film work or on TV, she's a completely different person than when you see her in print work, and it's that is something that we definitely have to fight back against.
Amanda, where do you find that this attitude, this bias against fat people comes from? And does some of that negative attitude stem from advice from the medical world about the health effects of obesity and what a harmful condition it can be? Does some of that then trickle into fat equals bad?
I think that it's multidimensional. I think that first and foremost, yes, the way that we assume that fat people are inherently diseased is incredibly harmful. There is a lot of research that shows that it has far more to do with behaviors than body size. That if you look that even health within itself is not just about body size, that it includes your socioeconomic status. It includes, do you have access to fresh fruits and vegetables? Do you have access to places to move your body? Do you have access to preventive medicine? Also dealing with stigma. I mean, fat people mm-hmm. deal with stigma, so do people of color, so do women, as well as people in the LGBT community. Also, when we talk about discrimination, we see that the people that are most likely to be discriminated against are women of color, poor people. So that means that women, they're less likely to be hired, they're less likely to be promoted, they're more likely to face discrimination in person, in interpersonal relationships. And that's where it's not just about medicine, that it also goes into issues of feminism, of gender. There's definitely an extreme amount of gendered discrimination that has so much to do with just women in general and embodiment and what it means to be feminine and what it means to be female that does really go into discrimination as well, that it's not just about the health portion of it, although that part definitely impacts how fat women specifically are able to engage in body positivity, because we're constantly told that you can be body positive, but you can't be fat, you know?
And yeah. So what's the key to being a fat woman, a fat person who is body positive?
For me, I'm very disassociated from negative body image culture, very, very disassociated from media that has to portray bodies in a specific way. I try to disassociate myself from people that are negative. That means not talking to people or engaging in diet culture, engaging in moralizing of food, because for me and a lot of fat activists, we talk about a health system. It's called Health at Every Size. And one of the main proponents for me was learning that food is food. It's okay to enjoy it. It's okay to eat food, like, in, you know, and it doesn't mean that I'm constantly eating cupcakes, but if I want to have a cupcake, that's okay, you know? And it's also not berating myself if I have a cupcake, you know? So it's kind of removing all of the kind of feelings that we have about food.
What about fat politics? What does that look like in Michigan? What kind of activities are happening and what kind of activism is happening?
I do a lot of work within fat studies, which is kind of a growing movement that's very, very similar and is following the lead of like women's studies or African-American studies. We have a lot of fat studies scholars throughout the states at U of M, MSU. I'm at Wayne State, obviously. We also have, I know MSU has Body Peace Corps, which is a student-run organization, which is super awesome. I know that they do like a body monologue every year. It's kind of like the vagina monologues, but instead it's people coming and talking about their body. I was running a nonprofit for a while, but because I'm in grad school, it just wasn't feasible anymore. But a lot of it is also online and engaging with people in other places. I talk to people from Australia, from New Zealand to, you know, East Coast, West Coast, all over the country, all over the world about body politics, because it is, yes, it is very a Western idea and is very, very focused on the U.S., but there are people all over the place that I engage with on Tumblr and Twitter that I talk to about this stuff.
What's your hope for the fat activist movement? Where do you hope that we will be as a society when we look at fat people in just, let's say, 5 years?
I really hope that we start listening to fat studies scholars, but also critically thinking about the way that we talk about bodies in society and also who we listen to, you know, with the American Medical Association defining fat or obesity as a disease. But when they did that, they went against a lot of research and the entire council that they had to decide whether they should do that or not. And I really, really, really would love to disassociate the corporate interests and the diet industry away from what we actually should be talking about, which is systemic issues, which is about equality and not just about health.
Amanda Levitt, she writes the blog Fat Body Politics and part of the fat activist movement in Michigan. Thanks for talking with us. She was kind enough to join us in the studio.
Thank you.
Let us know what is on your mind. What stories are you focusing on these days? What issues do you want us to talk about here on Stateside? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook and reach out. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And you can always find us right on the website, michiganradio.org, and just click on the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As a parent, you send your child off to school each and every day. And with that act, you entrust the safety of your child to the people who run that school. But one day after the horrifying school shooting in Nevada, we wanted to ask, how safe are Michigan schools? A new report revealed Michigan is among four states who do not require K through 12 schools to have emergency plans for multiple hazards, and we wanted to find out why. Even more, the study from the group Save the Children found that more than half the states and the District of Columbia do not require schools or daycare centers to meet minimum standards to protect children during major emergencies. Are Michigan school children adequately protected? What more can and should be done to keep them as safe as possible? Joining us is Jeanne-Mae Desmarais. She's the Senior Director of U.S. Emergencies for Save the Children, and she joins us from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And we're joined by Kyle Garant, who's Director of School Support Services for the state of Michigan, and he joins us from Lansing. Good to have you with us, Kyle.
It's great to be here.
Jeanne-Mae, I'd like to begin by getting an understanding for us. What criteria did you set for this study that Save the Children did on school hazard plans?
Well, this is the sixth year that Save the Children has put out a report card that looks at four very basic indicators of emergency preparedness. Three of them focus on child care, and one of them focuses on K-12 schools. So the requirement is that kindergarten through 12th grade schools in the state would be required to have a multi-hazard emergency plan in place. The report card also looks at, as I said, three basic indicators for child care. And those include, do all regulated child care facilities in the state, both centers and group homes, do they require a written emergency plan, including a relocation plan? Does it include emergency reunification plan with the families? And then also, does their plan, the written emergency plan, include provisions for children with special needs or very young children who need assistance to evacuate?
So in order to get the data, did you study state mandates? You went state by state and the District of Columbia to see what was present?
Yes. Save the Children has a researcher who comes in and actually looks state by state at regulations and what is mandated through policy or procedures or law in that state. And right now, the state of Michigan is not meeting those basic indicators of emergency preparedness planning. And Michigan's not alone in that. There are right now four states meet none of the indicators, and that's the grouping that Michigan is in. Since the beginning, when we first released the report card in 2008, only four states met all four basic criteria for preparedness. We've now worked with states, and many more meet it, but 28 states still do not yet meet the requirements. And again, these are minimum standards for preparedness. These are not elaborate, you know, reaching high goals. These are really the most basic things that child care facilities and schools need to have in place to help ensure the safety and protection of children.
Kyle Garant, your Director of School Support Services for our state. Should parents be concerned that not enough is being done by the state to keep kids safe?
Well, I think, I think we can always do more. I will say, though, that in Michigan, while we don't have a mandate statutorily to collect a plan from a district, there are many, if not most, school districts in our state have an emergency response plan that deals with all hazard incidences, and they typically work with their county emergency manager as part of a more global plan that looks at a community, with the school being, you know, a vital part of that plan. So we know of school districts that have worked really hard and have trained really hard to ensure their students and staff are safe during the school year.
I'm wondering, should something like this be mandated on a state level, or is it better to allow the local districts to figure out what works best for them?
Well, there are many ways to achieve it. It doesn't have to be mandated through law. It can be also mandated and documented through procedural requirements. What is important, though, is that the state requires all schools to have a multi-hazard plan in place, and that's where Michigan falls short. There are many schools in Michigan who do have plans in place, but all of those plans may not be multi-hazard, which means that they may have good plans for one type of disaster, but they may not take into consideration all of the different types of disasters, or they may not include the level of collaboration with emergency management officials that really is needed to ensure effective planning. The other thing that we've seen across the country is very often communities who are affluent and who have a lot of resources have stronger plans in place, but it's often the communities with less resources that are not able to have as strong planning in place, and really it puts those children at risk. So Save the Children believes that it needs to be mandated at the state level that all schools have strong multi-hazard plans in place.
Kyle, do we see a fairly uniform sense of planning in place, or do we see, is it more patchwork throughout Michigan?
You know, I think you see a more uniform planning process now, that, you know, a process and kind of tool, you know, in terms of a product that comes out of that planning process. Jean-Aimé makes an excellent point about the need for collaboration and coordination with first responders and units of police and local emergency managers at the local level. And that can be achieved through a mandate, but it also can be achieved without a mandate. And, you know, with the lack of a mandate here in Michigan, we have great examples in communities across our state that have done the work and have formed relationships necessary to do the proper planning to ensure that kids are safe in school and that everybody plays their role and knows what their role is, no matter what the incident may be. We do have a mandate here in Michigan to conduct a certain number of emergency drills in our state, 6 fire drills, 2 tornado drills, and then 2 safety drills, one of which needs to be a shelter in place, so an active shooter type situation, and a school lockdown piece. And, you know, as a parent, you know, where my daughter goes to school at, she's had a couple instances where there was stuff that was going on outside of the school building that required the district to either evacuate kids because of a gas leak or because there was something going on in the community that required the school to be in lockdown. So, you know, while a mandate doesn't exist, we have great examples all over the state of districts that have a plan and that they practice that plan, because a mandate to have a plan in place and if it's on a shelf doesn't do anyone any good. So kind of our role here at the Department of Ed has been focused on trying to foster that collaboration with our partners at the Michigan State Police and the Department of Community Health at the state level and at the local level, and also help provide resources that local schools and community partners can use to help plan their process and to plan the document that they developed that's their school safety plan.
That was Kyle Garant speaking. He's Director of School Support Services for the state of Michigan, working for the Department of Education. We're also speaking with Jean-Aimé Desmarais, who's the Senior Director of U.S. Emergencies for the group Save the Children, which issued a report that found that Michigan's 1 of 4 states that does not require K-12 schools to have emergency plans for multiple hazards. Now, Kyle raised an interesting point, Jean-Aimé, that a mandate that sits on a shelf doesn't necessarily do what it's meant to do. How assured are you that the states with the mandates, that they're being followed and being executed?
To really ensure the protection of children in emergencies and disasters, it takes a community commitment. It's not just the schools and the child care program. Those, of course, that's where the children spend a majority of their days. So those are first line. But then it's also the families participating in that planning, the emergency management officials from the community being a part of it, surrounding, you know, businesses and other community members who are close by to schools also play a critical role in supporting that emergency plan, so that if a disaster or a tragedy happens in a community, really everyone in the community knows what actions to take to best protect and support children when that happens.
You know, when something like a Sandy Hook or a Columbine happens, there was so much national conversation, and amongst that there was the observation made that if someone like an Adam Lanza comes in determined to do great harm, really, what could really be done to keep that harm from happening? I mean, do we want to see kids living with that sense of armed guards, armed teachers, with mandated rules? Could they really make a difference?
I think one of the things that could make a tremendous difference is taking a really serious approach to addressing the mental health concerns that are in the communities. There is something, you know, that is not addressed and that is behind the violence. And so the actual weapons are only one piece of the consideration. It's really got to be an approach that addresses bullying in the schools, that addresses stigmatization of children or people who may have mental illnesses, and effective support services for children to ensure that as they're growing up, they really are able to be supportive to achieve their full growth and potential, and to not really be, you know, cobbled by some of the challenges that exist in the world.
Kyle, as you look at what's in place at schools throughout Michigan, what's your sense with that question, that tension, if you will, between having a lot of safeguards in play and also an understanding of what can't really be controlled?
The mental health aspect is big, and you saw, you know, after the horrible events at Sandy Hook, Governor Snyder appointed a mental health commission to look at how we can retool our mental health system here in Michigan to work more on the preventative end of addressing needs that both adults and children have in our state around mental health needs. And also, as part of kind of that response, the governor called upon state agencies to develop a school safety work group that has been meeting over the last year to look at recommendations for how we can improve the safety of kids in schools and make recommendations, but also move forward on kind of policy initiatives that would better address the kind of climate and culture in schools to, again, work on the preventative end so you're not at a point where we're talking about teachers and in schools with guns to protect kids, because as you kind of point out, once it gets to that point, all the planning and kind of process in the world that has gone into keeping that building safe, you know, more than likely somebody's going to be hurt in the time that it takes for, you know, law enforcement or others to respond to that type of a situation. So, in this case, the best defense is a good offense, and working on the mental health aspect is really key to the overall safety of schools and children and other environments in our state.
I saw some quotes from one of the parents who lost a six-year-old daughter at Sandy Hook, talking about parents need to be aware of safety measures. And his comment was that some of the easiest solutions are the least expensive. So, for example, at Sandy Hook, the teacher could only lock the classroom door with a key on the outside of the doorknob, not a door that locked from the inside. Should that type of thing be mandated? Can a parent feel confident that a school district is thinking down to the nuts and bolts like that, Kyle?
It's funny you mention that, because when school started this year at my daughter's school, she's a first grader now, and last year they didn't have electronic locks, and this year they do. And I know it was part of a bond passage that happened in our community. But I think schools are very cognizant of those tangible, maybe seemingly minor fixes that can have a great impact. So if you're doing the planning and the process right in terms of working with your partners at the local level, those are the types of things that are taken in consideration, and engaging parents in that conversation is very key, because they're the ones that are in the building every day. I know myself, some of the procedures that were in place before, you rush around to get your son or daughter in the building in the morning, and you don't want to stop in the office and let them know who's in the building. And so, the more we can work to kind of automate that safety and to put things like electronic locks and having one entry point into the building in schools, I think the better off everyone is.
Shadami DeMarais, from what you've done and the work you've done with Save the Children, and you're the senior director of U.S. Emergencies, so you've seen what can play out. What's your main advice to parents who want to be involved and want to be aware?
Well, I think most parents in the U.S. just assume when they drop their children off, whether at childcare or at schools, that there's a plan in place. Parents have to ask, and parents should be active participants in that plan. Parents need to make sure that they give their updated emergency contact numbers, both their own cell phones, but also it's recommended an out-of-city or somebody right out of your local areas as a backup emergency contact in case the local phones are not working. Parents need to ask good questions and make sure that they understand, and then also that their children understand what the procedures and plans are when a disaster happens.
That was Jean-Ami Desmarais, who's with Save the Children. She joined us from Washington. And Kyle Garant, who's not only director of school support services for the state of Michigan, clearly the father of a first grader and is living it as an active, involved dad as well. And he joined us from Lansing. We want to thank both of you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
In the face of the Detroit bankruptcy filing, the Detroit Institute of Arts has been talked about a lot lately, and that got us thinking about other museums in the state. Here's a lesser-known museum that got our attention. It's the Bay City Antique Toy and Firehouse Museum. Jimmy Dobson is the owner and curator of this 125,000-square-foot museum.
There's a large display of horse-drawn and hand-drawn fire trucks that go back as far as 1854. We have 60 motorized fire trucks, and these go back to 1914 to 1973.
As its name suggests, the museum also has toys, over 12,000 of them. Some go back as far as 1926.
My late son was an avid toy collector, and of course his big collection in this building also is one of the largest NASCAR collections in the country.
Dobson's favorite piece is the New York Super Pumper. People come from all over the world to see it. It sounds like it's pretty hard to miss.
It's quite a story. It's the only one that they've ever manufactured, and it required 45 men a day to run it. So eventually in 1983, I bought it from the New York Fire Department. And it cost $883,000 when it was new in 1963. Also, the first time that they used it, they hooked it to 8 hydrants in downtown New York, and it was so powerful to pull the hydrants right out of the ground. So at that point, from the day on, you could only pump out of the Hudson River.
Jimmy, what's the target audience for the Toy and Fire Truck Museum?
It's kind of a diversified situation. You come in, we've got something for the women, we've got something for the boys, the kids, and everything else.
The Bay City Antique Toy and Firehouse Museum is open during the weekend throughout the month of October. And if you have a museum you think we should know about, get in touch with us at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.